This week, Lori Shelley sent me in the mail a Reader's Digest article. And the note on it said, "I thought of you from this reading." And I thought, wow, I'll just do this reading rather than the reflection. But I'm just going to do part of it from this author relating experiences of joy, where they felt awe and wonder and joy and connection. She describes an experience where they end up getting out of the rain and difficult driving and pulled over, and all of a sudden there was this beautiful light. The very road shone and a rainbow arched across the sky. It was as though this beam of color had been built for us alone. We could hardly speak for awe and joy. She says, a friend of mine has described a similar experience. She had walked out on a lonely beach at twilight. It was a time of grief for her, and loneliness was what she wanted. Offshore across the darkening sea, she made out the image of an anchored fishing boat, and in it, the figure of a man. My friend told me that after a while, she felt an intense and glowing sense of oneness with that silent figure. It was as though sea and sky and night and those two solitary human beings were united in a kind of profound identity. I was overtaken by joy, she said. Most of us have experienced such lighted moments when we seem to understand ourselves and the world, and for a single instant know the loveliness of living beings, and I would add, of being alive. But these moments vanish quickly, and we are almost embarrassed to admit that they have ever been. Psychologist Abraham Maslow of Brandeis University calls these experiences peak experiences. I wouldn't call them necessarily that. But he says, in his files, for example, is the story of a young mother getting breakfast for her family. She hurried about the kitchen, pouring orange juice and coffee, spreading jam on toast. The children were chattering. The sun streamed in on their faces. Her husband was playing with the littlest one. All was usual. But as she looked at them, she was suddenly so overcome by how much she loved them that she could scarcely speak for joy. Apparently, almost anything may serve as the impetus of such a feeling. Sunshine on new snow, a sudden field of daffodils, a moment in marriage when hand reaches out to hand in the realization that this other person speaks as you speak, feels as you feel. Joy may wait too, just beyond danger, when you have enough to face a situation and live it out. Joy is much more than happiness. It is exultation of spirit, says the dictionary. Gladness, delight, a state of felicity. Awe and a sense of mystery are a part of it. So are humility and gratitude. Suddenly, we are keenly aware of every living thing. The most important thing in these experiences, says Maslow, is the feeling that people had really glimpsed the essence of things, the secret of life, as if veils had been pulled aside. We see, too, the unity of things. A dazzling vision of the kinship we all have with one another and with the universal life around us. Everyone who has ever had such a moment has noted this quality of melting into. The sad thing is that it happens to most of us so rarely. As we grow older, our lives become buried under the pressures of the workaday world. Joy is not likely to come to us when we are going round and round the tormenting circle of our own busyness. Instead, it seems that when life's transiency and frailty are omnipresent, what we have grows sweeter. Perhaps we're more likely to experience a moment of joy if we can admit that there is more to life than we have fathomed, if we can acknowledge a world greater than our own. To be sure, the experience of joy is not necessarily religious in a conventional way, but a characteristic is the feeling people have that they have touched the hem of something far beyond themselves. What if these moments of joy are given to us to reveal that this is the way we are meant to live? What if the clarity of joy is the way we should be seeing all the time? What if the clarity of joy is the way we should be seeing all the time? To many people, it seems almost wicked to feel this radiance in a world threatened as ours is. But most generations have known uncertainty and challenge and peril. The more grievous the world, the more we need to remember the luminous beauty at the center of life. Our moments of joy are proof that at the heart of darkness, an unquenchable light shines. This article originally appeared in the April 1965 issue of Reader's Digest. And the concluding little bit is from our embodiment materials of Soul Matters, and it's from the poet Sarah Kay from her poem, The Paradox. I spend most time wondering if I should be somewhere else. Instead, I'm learning to shape the words thank you with my first breath each morning, my last breath each night. So when the very last breath comes, at least I will know I was grateful for all the places I was so sure I was not supposed to be. We've spent in times in this last month reflecting on joy, and I'll come back around to that, obviously. This talk was going to be an Earth Day talk, but then we had a substitute during that time, so I bring it back now. Actually, I created it this week. And one of the things that came to mind during this was a story from baseball season. Baseball season has started. The Asheville tourists are beginning to play their games. We have a group here who goes to Asheville tourist games two or three times a year. Neil has stepped out, but I was going to ask him for some references, but they're about, I think Ken goes, there are about 8, 9, 10 guys who get together and go. And over the years, I've been invited. Well, one of the times I went, it was years ago, I went and there were people who are no longer alive anymore. Francis Underhill, remember John Ulinski, Dean Crawford, and Fred Harris were several of them. And I went there, and they had their own special seat, their own place that they always went, and it was right behind the left field dugout. And they took a red and white checkered tablecloth and spread it on the roof of the dugout. And that was so they could put the food they ordered from the concession stand right out there in front of them, food and beer. What you have to know is that four of those people had had multiple bypass operations. And this was their chance to eat cheeseburgers and cheese fries. right there together, sort of in celebration and during those ball games. Here I was. I didn't order any of that, but you can guess that. But there they were. That was a special part of their day. And you're wondering why I share that story. I share it because it embodies the whole situation around climate change. Yes, it does. I would start out by saying that from my perspective, climate change is as real as a heart attack. We're seeing the symptoms, as we go along. And whether we heed the warnings or not, it's dependent on our behavior. We can list those things. Carbon dioxide, greenhouse gas, has increased by 40% since the Industrial Revolution. And we know the mechanism by which it warms the planet. We can see cause and effect. And that's a 40% spike above the natural variation found in ice cores going back over thousands of years. NASA scientists look at multiple studies in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and over 97% of those studies in peer-reviewed scientific journals show that 97% or more of the show that they agree that climate warming trends over the past century are due to human activities. Since 1880, the average temperature of the Earth has warmed by 1.7 degrees Fahrenheit. Quote, that may sound low, but as an average over an entire planet, it is actually high, which explains why much of the world's land ice is starting to melt. The oceans are rising at an accelerating pace. Here's this interesting fact. The heat accumulating in the Earth because of human emissions is roughly equal to the heat that would be released by 400,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs exploding across the planet every day. And temperature data show rapid warming in the last few decades. Most and probably all of the warming has happened since 1950, or that's happened since 1950, is caused by human release of greenhouse gases. Why do people argue that climate change isn't real? That's a question I ask myself a lot, and it's mostly ideological. It's got to be. It's the ideology about how government should be involved in people's lives. So it's a reaction to government policies that are being promoted in response to this information. But instead of all of us working together to solve the problems, with perhaps, you know, more acceptable solutions across ideologies, like market-driven solutions, the approach has been to argue that what's happening isn't real, and to discredit the data that show it isn't real, and as a result, to even discredit the nature of scientific data as a way of making decisions. And it discredits the reasons for needing to act. Me personally, I listen to the science. That's my background. That's how I sort these things out. And to do this kind of looking for, and there are always scientists that you can find that will say something different. That's the nature of scientific conversation. That's the way it is. But to go about to just find examples that say something different would be kind of like Fred Harris when he got a diagnosis that he needed a triple bypass, going out to just try to find one doctor who would support his idea that he doesn't need to change his behavior because he doesn't like to have to eat that way. And he wants to convince his wife. I mean, you can just go around with that understanding. So with these facts or these statistics, it would be kind of like going to visit 100 doctors so you could find three who said that this really wasn't the right diagnosis. If you look at climate change, the climate and the range of climate variability within which our culture and economic system and population size have developed, we've seen this climate, we've lived in it, but now it's shifting, and it will shift in disruptive ways. We are putting the system that currently supports huge human population at risk. If we don't change our lifestyle, if we don't change our diet, our lifestyle will be changed for us. And then it doesn't look like we're going to change that lifestyle. So 2/3 of the global temperature rise since 1880 has happened in the last 30 to 40 years. It's occurred since 1975. And that's since we've known about the threat. I can remember being worried about climate change and having it affect how I made decisions about being involved in conservation biology. And I've shared with you even having a child in the early 1980s. So, all of that, why is this religious? Why is this something we're talking about here, or I am? I don't believe climate change is real. I know it. In the way that I know things and come to know things, I don't say to you, I believe it, I know it. But this is why I am religious, is the very fact of climate change. I had to come to terms with fear, with grief, with the feeling of loss from the things that I was trying to do to make a difference in the world. I had to come to terms with the chronic sense of an uncertain future. I had to ask the question, what does it mean to live well, given this understanding? What does it mean to live with an inclusive vision of how we are to be in relation to all beings and other people? What does an engaged ethic mean in this context? I had to come to terms with an existential threat as I felt it, with anxiety being created in my life. John Dorhauer, the president of the United Church of Christ, says that our theology, or the theology of the Church of Christ, hasn't taken into account the realities of climate change. And until it does and offers hope that can address that, we aren't doing the job we should be doing. So this morning, I'm going to address that hope real quickly. I don't have a belief in an intervening or managing God. That doesn't mean I don't have a belief or a view of a sense of something more and a connectedness beyond me or the sense of joy that I'm talking about. So how does hope work? First, we do what we can. That's the larger aspect of hope. We do what we can to change the future, the hope that we can make a difference. That's when we list the things that we take action doing. Things like fly less, drive less, waste less, eat less meat. Fly less. If you flew one fewer time than you're going to fly this year, that would be the equivalent of the difference you're making with everything else you're doing in one flight. Okay? Many of us here are travelers. That doesn't mean don't travel. It just says fly less. With these heart guys, it doesn't mean they don't eat cheeseburgers. They don't eat cheese fries. You hope they've changed their diet. You hope they exercise more. But they don't cut that out completely. And I can tell you from that experience, they really appreciate those things when they do them. They don't just take them for granted. They put a tablecloth on top of the dugout. Wendell Berry talks about the futility of global thinking in these large issues that are in the world. And he says we have to then act within what he calls the scale of our competence. Knowing how important government policy is, that's when it gets into the politics. We need to be acting at the state and national and international level. We need to be acting here locally. There's a recent book called The Climate of Hope, which focuses that hope here, from Michael Bloomberg and Carl Pope, who's the head of the Sierra Club. they say they think we can survive the setbacks that may happen in policy because of what towns and cities are doing if people focus on their local lives. So it's important that we get involved, engaged in our lives, in our town, in our world, even in the face of this large existential threat. And then there's another hope. As there's a big one, it's the hope in. That's the hope that there is joy in the presence, in the present, as in our readings this morning. It's joy that wells up. It's the force of life that's always trying to come forward, given half a chance, and we can notice it and feel it in every day if we don't discount it by what it isn't. If we don't say, this is not contributing to that big thing, it's not important. Our actions should not be discounted by what they aren't. This hope in is the hope that keeps us going in the face of problems much bigger than ourselves. It's an empowering hope. There is the hope that we can live in love and act from compassion connected to joy. And recognize it. Recognize it and empower it. So we can do that rather than always and only acting out of fear. The one builds strength, the one is sustainable, the other risks burnout without this other hope always being a part of it. Acting out of fear risks burnout, withdrawal from meaningful action. What do we say when we're done in? We say, I'm going to zone out. And you say, how do you do that? I'm going to zone out and watch the news. And then what do? Paralyzed. How does that do anything? Not much. And how does it connect you to joy? I can personally tell you that it disconnects me from it. The time I spend in front of that screen disconnects me from the connections with the world. If you look at these men, all with quadruple bypasses or more, they enjoy the baseball game and their greasy, salty ballpark food. They enjoy themselves. And even with this diagnosis, prognosis situation, I bet they find joy in their grandchildren in those moments. What if those moments are in every day? For my daughter Hannah, I do my part to change the world, but I sometimes, at the same time, enjoy my time with her. She was here this last week, and I had all these things to do, and I dropped several of them, and even the fear that I was going to catch hell because I wasn't going to get them right so I could be present. Present with the lives around me. Gabriel Marcel speaks of this as a relational hope, and he uses the phrase, I trust in thee for us. We will live our lives connected and real, or practicing and noticing. What if these moments of joy are the way we should be seeing all the time? This afternoon, Charlie and Pam Rogers are going to be leading a workshop on compassionate conversations. It doesn't change, those workshops don't change what's on the news. They don't change that what is taking me away from myself. Away from myself. And what is yourself? It really is your home of hope. It's not out there. It lives in here, my home of hope. But what it does is it brings me back to that and into an action that I can take. I get excited by it. And when I frame it this way, I actually feel more whole and real. And I feel more in myself and in this gift of life I've been given. Friday evening, we had a Soul Matters group, which was families, parents and children, we had childcare at that moment. But we were talking about big problems and of the world and sitting around as the adults and talking about this. And Leela, who was up here and lit the chalice, right as sort of a last minute, said, and she was real excited by it, she said, "I remember Mark Mullinax's talk, and he says, when you feel like you're covered over in, I'm not sure what word he uses, but unprocessed organic matter, he said, be like the earthworm." And she just said it like that, earthworm. We can be earthworms. What is an earthworm? It's something good for life, organically good for life. If you turn in your hymnal to 568, Marge Piercy, she says, "Connections are made slowly," and it becomes a reading. I'd never seen it this way before, but it actually becomes a reading of hope and a reading for how to make it real. It says, "Penetrate quietly as the earthworm that blows no trumpet. Fight persistently as the creeper that brings down the tree." It goes on to then say just what we've been saying. Live a life you can endure. Make love that is loving. Live as if you like yourself, and it may happen. Reach out, keep reaching out, keep bringing in, no matter the future. Give power and importance to living like the earthworm. So then when you read from Soul Matters, our reading, "I spend most time wondering if I should be somewhere else." So when the very, I say thank you, shape the words with the first breath each morning, my last breath each night. So when the very last breath comes, at least I will know I was grateful for all the places I was so sure I was not supposed to be. In that reading, you are actually experiencing, if you do that, where you have power to generate and connect to the hope that changes your world, your life opportunity, and then spreads to change the world.